Nationwide Mutual Fire Insurance Company, ML, versus Erie Insurance Company, Carter S. Truman, Helen Council, Don P. O'Haron, Michael D. Masterson, Appalachian Council.
You may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Robert Friedman. I'm here on behalf of the appellants. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, please.
All right.
In Nationwide 1, this court held that Erie's coverage position was erroneous. What we're here today for, what this case is about, is which party bears the risk of that erroneous coverage position, Nationwide or Erie?
Isn't the question which party bears the risk of a payment made prior to that decision at a time where a circuit court opinion had held that up to $3 million your client had 100% of the risk and there was no common obligation whatsoever to be shared?
Well, there are two issues. There is payment, but there's also a question of the disclaiming coverage position taken after the trial court's decision. So two things happened. Nationwide did settle the case. However, prior to that settlement, but following the trial court's ruling, Erie said, we don't provide indemnification coverage with respect to this $2.9 million demand.
Right, because they had a judicial order that said they had no liability up to $3 million, purely excess. So at the time of the payment, there was no common obligation as a matter of law. Now, you got it reversed. Great win. You deserved it. But you didn't hold up the settlement. You prematurely settled the case before there was a common obligation that even accrued in law.
Well, respectfully, Your Honor's comment that it was prematurely settled, the tort action was scheduled for trial mere weeks, less than a month.
I get that. I mean, you could have done a conditional settlement. The point is that the common obligation doctrine has to be put in a time frame. It can't be retrospective, otherwise it takes away the rights of tendering the defense, right?
But this court held in Nationwide 1 that coverage obligation existed throughout the pendency of that trial.
We held that after the payment was made.
That's correct.
So when you get a tender of defense to a co-obligor, the point is, look, if you don't like my 2.9 settlement, then you try the darn case. And that is a good thing, because then the party who's given the tender of defense can say to themselves, yeah, I'm not paying 2.9, and I don't want to deal with half of it later. I can get this case for under $300,000 in a heartbeat. That's the point of tendering the defense. At the time you sought your claim, it was after we had reversed the trial court. It's too late. The payment had already been made.
I think the issue comes down to what the effect of Erie's position. So I understand your court's point as far as the court's point as far as Nationwide's conduct. Nationwide did settle the case. That's undisputed. They settled it before the appeals process, before this court was able to play out. And we settled it before the tort action. I think when it comes to the issues of waiver and estoppel, however, the issue is Erie's conduct. And Erie's conduct is after the trial court decision, they disclaim coverage for that first $3 million in indemnification coverage.
Because a trial court said they were right.
I understand why they did that, but the fact remains that disclaimer was erroneous. It was based on erroneous coverage position.
After the fact it was erroneous, it was absolutely correct at the time they disclaimed it. A judicial court had held it's exactly what the law is.
But it wasn't what their insurance policy said. At the time, their insurance policy, which predated any of this, that's where the duties arise from. That's where their duty.
If I can freeze frame my question, then I'll leave you alone. At the whole idea of the common contribution, the equitable contribution concept, presupposes sharing a common obligation, correct?
Yes.
Doesn't that necessarily presuppose a common obligation at the time of the payment, as opposed to after the fact, post hoc?
I understand the court's question, and my response would be the obligation, the source of the obligation, is not the trial court, and it's not even necessarily this court. The source of the obligation is the insurance policy. The source of the obligation is their contractual promises they made. And they made those promises before the tort suit ever even happened. That's the source of their obligation. The promises they made to their insurer.
If you'd have lost on appeal to us again, as opposed to winning on appeal, you'd still be able to make your argument there?
No. If we lost on appeal, there would be no common obligation, because we were wrong as to what their policy said, but we were right as to what their policy said.
not at the time you made your settlement.
Respectfully, I do think we were correct. The fact that this court hadn't overturned the trial court, what gives rise to the duty to defend, and more importantly here, the duty to indemnify, are the promises made in the insurance policy when the policy was issued. That's when the obligation attaches. The fact that they had taken an erroneous coverage position and this court didn't have the opportunity to set them straight prior to the tort action being scheduled for trial, that didn't create, their obligations didn't change. Their obligations were set forth in their policy. This court simply corrected the error of the trial court. But their obligations are from their insurance policy, not from what the court tells them. I think the question here is what the risky behavior is. What's the risky conduct in Virginia? Is it to disclaim indemnification coverage in light of a demand, in the face of a demand made against your insured who's facing significant excess exposure, as Erie did? Or is it to protect the insured, as Nationwide ultimately did? The answer to that clearly has to be the former. The crux of this, the common obligation argument and the crux of it, is the consent to settlement clause. That is why Erie says there was no common obligation, because our policy's got a consent to settle clause, and we didn't consent to the settlement. Thus, there can be no common obligation. That's the heart of this matter, the consent to settlement clause. It follows that if that's been waived or they're stopped from relying upon it, then their argument as to why there is no common obligation fails. With respect to waiver, it's black letter law that an insurance company that denies coverage waives its right to rely on a consent to settlement provision. That's also common sense. If you submit a claim to your insurer and they say, sorry, not us, then you settle the case. They can't complain you've settled the case if it indeed turns out that it was their obligation. That's black letter law. The question is here, and Erie suggests that, well, we didn't really deny coverage. I'll grant you, it wasn't a blanket denial. They admit, they conceded they had some excess exposure.
They didn't deny coverage. The trial court denied coverage. Trial court held there was no coverage up to $3 million and the settlement was $2.9 million.
But after that decision, Erie issued a letter saying, we are not going to provide indemnification coverage for the first $3 million. That's what the letter, in essence, said, is that it's your responsibility. We are denying indemnification coverage, our indemnification obligations, up to the $3 million threshold.
Because they won the case.
I understand why they did it. I'm not confused as to why Erie took the position that they took. The issue is they were wrong, and they bore the risk of being wrong. They were wrong at the time. I understand they had a trial court determination telling them they were right, but that wasn't the end of the process. What ultimately determines whether they're right or wrong is what their obligations are in the policy. And as this court correctly held in Nationwide One, their obligations were primary.
Suppose they had disagreed with 2.9. Suppose they said, look, you're overselling the case for some reason. I don't know why, but we can get this below $500,000. They should, in the face of a circuit court that says you have no liability at all up to three, they should exercise the takeover defense?
I think it would be different if the issue, I think the reason why they refuse to contribute to the settlement is key here. Now, had they said, look, you've come to us, there's a $2.9 million settlement, as Your Honor suggests, you know, way too high, we think it ought to be less or something, we are not going to contribute because we think it's not being valued right, that's totally different, because that's not what waiver's about. Waiver isn't, our complaint here isn't we asked them to contribute and they said no. The issue here is they said no because they were disclaiming indemnification coverage. Their reason matters. If their reason was these numbers are crazy, that's different.
Of all the cases you all have cited, I was unable to find one that said that a common obligation exists for equitable contribution at a time in which one of the parties against which the claim is made had a judicial ruling that they had zero liability for the claim.
I've not located that case either. I think for obvious reasons, this is a somewhat unique circumstance, and a lot of it's driven by timing here.
But doesn't that mean something's wrong here? That the fact that that's never come up, and the common obligation has always existed at the time of the payment, and the policy is to allow the takeover option. But here the takeover option is gone. They can't do anything. The settlement's been made. They can't now say, okay, well, we didn't know we had any liability. We had a trial court that said we had no liability up to $3 million. Supreme Court of Virginia, what, grants 5% of their cases. We're right. The trial court is right. You're not going to get it reversed. And they find out they guessed wrong. We did reverse it. They can't do anything about it now. They can't come in and say, well, the case wasn't worth more than $500,000. And you paid 2.9 and we got to eat half of that?
That's correct. And that's why insurers in Virginia have to think long and hard before you disclaim coverage. Disclaiming coverage does have dramatic effects. And that's the case law as it exists, is that if you disclaim coverage, in any contract for that matter, if you disclaim your obligations, the other side is released from those obligations. And the case law is specific in Virginia as to the issue of consent to settle. Specifically, if you deny coverage, you waive your consent to settle. When Erie said, we're just not doing anything because we have no coverage obligations, they did take a risky position. And as you said, they did guess wrong. And the question is, it's not inequitable to suggest that there's some consequence to the fact that they guessed wrong. Insurers, when they disclaim coverage, are putting themselves out there. You better be right. If you disclaim coverage, you better be right. Because if you're not, you need to live with whatever happens. And that's true in any case where you disclaim coverage, regardless of the complexities of this case. If your insurer submits a claim to you, and you say, sorry, I can't help you, we don't have coverage, you're taking the risk that there's a judgment. There could be a default judgment in that case, because you didn't defend. And if it turns out your coverage determination was incorrect, you're going to owe that default judgment.
But wouldn't you owe it to your insurer, not to another insurance company? And in this particular instance, their insurer doesn't know anything.
Ordinarily, that is the case. This court has before held that one insurer can seek reimbursement from another insurer. I think that's where the equitable part of equitable contribution comes from. I think equitable subrogation goes to that point, too, that the duties do flow essentially through the insurer. This isn't the typical case, I'll grant you, with where the insurer and the insurer sits, but I don't think that's in any way fatal here. I think the court has repeatedly recognized one insurer's
ability. Is it even relevant? Why do we care whether or not the agreement to settle clause, consent to settle clause, is applicable? It's just not equitable because there was no common obligation at the time of the payment, so we don't even get to waivers of anything.
Well, Erie's argument was based on the reason.
I know they made the argument, but they also made the argument that precedes it, which is no common obligation at the time of the payment.
I understand the argument to solely be there's no common obligation at the time of payment because we have a consent to settlement clause. But I understand that the court may disagree, but my position is what I said, that the common obligation existed at the time. The policy they issued, which is where all their obligations come from. Their obligations come from the contract. The court interprets the contract, but the court doesn't create the obligation. It's the policy that creates it.
Well, let me hypothesize a conversation with you. Suppose I'm the lawyer for Erie after I just won the circuit court case, and you say, I got, Mr. Kelsey, I got a $2.9 million settlement on the table. If you want to be a hero, take it over, you're welcome to it. I'm just tendering it to you. And I go, well, are you going to sue me later for it? He goes, absolutely, I will if I have to pay it myself. Why? Because there's a common obligation. A common obligation? I just won. Didn't I just win this case? A court just told me I have zero obligation. How do I have a common obligation? If you don't pay, if you don't take it over, you're going to have to pay half of it later. Because I have a common obligation that a court just told me I don't have. I mean, I don't even follow the logic. I don't know how I'd respond to that telephone call if I imagine myself in that situation.
I think there are other ways around it. One thing is to come to a funding agreement saying, look, we'll agree to do it this way because this case hasn't reached its end.
Well, that's what I think Nationwide could have easily done here. I mean, this is not the first time something like this has happened. You could have done a contingent agreement.
Well, we can't mandate that, right? We need Erie to come to the table.
No, contingent agreement with the plaintiff, with the tort plaintiff.
Well, I don't think there can be there. I think the funding agreement would have to be with the other insurer. And we can't force Erie to enter into an agreement that, you know, if we win, we'll come back and be able to. Erie's not going to agree to that, as clear in their letter. They say we have no coverage obligations.
Would you like to save the remainder of your time?
I would. Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. John O'Haron on behalf of Erie Insurance, joined by my co-counsel, Mike Matheson. The law cannot imply a contract that overrides an express one, and that's what Nationwide is trying to do here. Equitable contribution case is an implied contractual theory. Erie has express contractual rights under its insurance policy with its insured to only be liable under its policy under two events, a judgment at trial or its written consent. It is pled on the face of the complaint and not contested that those did not occur. The existence of a condition precedent on the face of the complaint and the fact that it was not fulfilled was on the face of the complaint. Under this court's case decision in Allstate versus USAA, there is no common obligation here between co-insurers when these contractual conditions precedent exist. This court's decision in Allstate is directly applicable. There, two co-insurers did the same thing that these two co-insurers did, went back and forth before trial on whether to settle a case. USAA asked Allstate to contribute. Allstate refused. This court said on appeal that refusal, because you had conditions precedent to coverage, ends the inquiry. There is
no common obligation. There's more at play here, right?
There is. There's certainly unique factual circumstances regarding the...
I mean, because I thought the whole point of these equitable doctrines was it's a trump card of sorts where you may have a written contract that says one thing, but there's a legal trump card that comes in, and equity applies in a variety of contexts. I mean, what we're trying to figure out is, do you have a waiver, and should this equitable doctrine apply such that it trumps the written contractual obligation? If it's just a matter of the written contract, game over. But we're trying to figure out the scope of this equitable doctrine.
Agreed. The next point is waiver. I think this case does come down to whether this right has been waived.
Right.
I think, as Justice Kelsey noted, even if, aside from the question of waiver, no common obligation exists. But on the point of waiver, waiver is intentionally relinquishing a right. You can do it expressly, which has never occurred here. You can do it impliedly by your conduct. This right, it's important to note the right at issue, and I direct your Honor's attentions to JA 46 and JA 112, which contain the actual contractual rights. It's not simply that we have to consent to the settlement of the case. If that were true, us saying, you Nationwide go settle, we want no part in it, arguably could be construed as some type of waiver. But the right is not that. The right is that we don't have liability under our policy to pay unless we agree to it.
Or there's a judgment.
Or there's a judgment.
So if you lost the deck action in the trial court and you were appealing, you'd be hosed later if they settled it, gave a tentative defense, and you blew it all.
Agreed. And there's no judgment, and there's no... The letters that Nationwide cites as waiver, Erie's conduct in this case, according to Nationwide, does not manifest in any way an intent to relinquish its contract rights. This court has found in the insurance context, contractual conditions precedent. The waiver can happen if I, the insurance company, tell the insured that you no longer have to perform certain obligations, or if I, by my conduct, make clear that I no longer intend, as the insurer, to perform my obligations. Neither of those happened here. The right at issue is we, Erie, have the contractual right not to pay under this policy unless we agree in writing or unless there's a judgment at trial. Shortly after the declaratory judgment ruling by the trial court, our indication, our refusal to participate in the settlement, is not intending to relinquish those rights. It is an exercise of them. We are exercising our rights under our contract with our insured to determine our risks and obligations to our insured.
But what if you and the trial court turn out to be wrong?
That's a risk that Nationwide took. That's the risk that Nationwide took by settling it at the same time.
Isn't that a risk that Erie took by saying we're not going to consent to settlement because right now we have a judgment that says we don't have any obligation up to $3 million?
Well, I think it wasn't a risk because I think even with the reversal of this court did not impose a duty to settle, which is what you would have to get to.
It absolutely did not, but what it said was that Erie had an obligation up to the first $3 million.
Right, and by the time this court ruled, that settlement had already been made. And under the cusp of that...
I understand all of that, and I do understand the questions Justice Kelsey is asking as to the obligation at the time. But once this court reverses a circuit court, then doesn't that say there was an obligation at the time?
If it did, the obligation at the time was coverage obligations. You would have to then say that the obligation that existed at the time was to make a settlement payment. And neither this court's decision nor the analysis applicable to an insurer's duties to its insured gets you there. Nationwide has to construe the obligation as one to pay a settlement. And that does not exist here. This court stated in Allstate versus USAA that they can't litigate the bad faith or good faith duties that we had to our insured in a co-insurer context. They didn't bring a bad faith claim in this case. If they brought a bad faith claim, which they assert on brief we could have done against them had they not settled, if they had brought a bad faith claim as a subrogee, we might be analyzing this differently. But we're just looking at whether a common obligation existed. And even under this court's ruling, there's no obligation to pay a settlement. At that point, as Justice Kelsey's earlier question, we could have analyzed this case differently than being worth $2.9 million.
So if it had gone to trial and there had been a judgment, and then, meanwhile, this court reverses the trial court, then you would be liable to the extent of the policy.
I think so, if I followed Your Honor's question. I think so. But the only way to say that we had an obligation to settle this case is to conflate coverage obligations generally, our coverage primary after this court decision, to retroactively apply that, but then also to construe coverage obligations generally as duty to settle. And whether there was a duty to settle this case is not at issue in this equitable contribution case. We could have determined that there was a contributory negligence argument. We could have determined that the case wasn't worth $2.9 million. They are, Nationwide, they are the ones that determined on their own to settle this case. And for that reason, as we also argue in brief, to the extent there could be an obligation here, it's not shared. They determined their own rights and responsibilities to their insured. We, under our contract with our insured, have our own right to do that exact same thing.
So what would they have done in light of your position? We have no obligation. We're not consenting to anything because we don't have to consent to anything. So with regard to their ability to get your consent to settle, how would that play out in the real world?
Well, I think that assumes that our consent is something that assumes that there's a way for us to consent, that we have to consent. But they could have done multiple things. They could have defended the case from the outset, which they did not do. Erie is the one that tendered the defense to the insured and defended the case up until the point of the declaratory judgment ruling. Erie is the one that instituted the declaratory judgment action to clear that cloud on coverage. The second thing they could have done was attempted to intervene and stay the trial case while this court, during the pendency of the appeal. The third thing they could have done, which they didn't do, was they could have recovered possibly if they brought a bad faith claim. If they wanted to litigate that Erie's refusal to participate in the settlement was bad faith because we took an erroneous coverage position, as they've argued.
That seems like a dead end when you have at least one court buy in your argument. I mean, to say it's bad faith, but the judge agreed with our view, I'm just saying here.
Well, I think
maybe some other case. But
well, I think after this court's reversal, what I mean is in this context, they argue that they're sort of hung out to dry here. One of the things that they've opted not to do is bring a bad faith claim, which they include in their analysis as something bad that could have happened to them. Well, they didn't bring it here to argue that our refusal or our erroneous coverage position was bad faith. I'm not saying that it would have won, but it certainly...
Hanging out to dry, they had $3 million in coverage, right, at primary, according to the trial court, to settle for $2.9 million, and they can't make a bad faith claim against Erie because they just got a ruling from a circuit court that there was no Erie liability for anything. So where's the stress that they're under?
I don't think they are under one. I mean, I think they're... What I was referencing in response to Justice Powell's question is after this court's reversal, and they are now saying that we took an erroneous coverage position, they cast this case in terms of equities being against them, that they're sort of getting an unfair deal. What they could have done after the reversal is what I was referring to. And
right, I follow you. So, I mean, they had a judicial finding that said you're liable for the $3 million. If you want to play hardball, go for it. But you may, if it's bad faith, later have to go over your limits anyway. And they also knew that y'all picked up the excess, even under the trial court's review. So I guess the question I'm asking is a friendly question: is why did they feel like they're in a crack? They could settle the case in good faith and be under their limits, or if they wanted to defend the case and take a little bit of risk there, you pick up the overage anyway. Another worst case scenario for them.
I agree, Your Honor. I don't think that they are hung out to dry, and I don't think that the equities in this case, to the extent they're relevant...
Well, it's equitable. That's the big picture here that goes back to some of the questions you've heard. We're not dealing with law here. This is not common law at all. This is not contract law either, for that matter. It's equity. What's equitable?
Yes, and for the... Equity cannot impose an obligation here for the reasons I've said. We have an express contractual right here. And there is no obligation that existed at the time of the payment, which is the inquiry under this court's case law under equitable contribution. Was there a shared obligation at the time the payment was made? Because the circuit court had just ruled that we had no obligation, because we have these contractual conditions precedent that were not satisfied, there is no common obligation. So, Your Honors, this court's case law and waiver is clear that intent is the essence. You have to intend to relinquish your rights. Declining to participate in the settlement of this case is not intending to relinquish Erie's contractual rights. There is no estoppel in this case. For the reasons we argue on brief, Erie did not take inconsistent positions. Erie took initially a position on coverage, and in this litigation has taken a position on its conditions precedent. Those are not inconsistent, and Nationwide has also not argued reliance. It cites its own prejudice. That's not the question under estoppel. So this Nationwide is trying to dictate Erie's insurance rights in this case, and it can't do that. This court has said multiple times that in a co-insurer context, one co-insurer's decision on what to do under its policy cannot dictate the rights of the other insurance company. That's clear under this case's this court's decision in Allstate, this court's decision in Midwest Mutual. This court held in the Osborne case that these rights do not require a showing of prejudice. So our conditions precedent, Erie's conditions precedent in this case, on the face of the complaint, not satisfied. No common obligation existed at the time. And for the reasons discussed today and on our brief, there was no waiver. And so for those reasons, Your Honors, we ask this court to affirm the circuit court.
All right. Mr. Friedman, you have 56 seconds left.
May it please the court again. Obviously, I have very little time left, but the major point I want to hit was what just came out, that the worst case scenario, had Nationwide not settled the case, would be that Erie would just pick up the excess coverage. That is not the case. This was a case of excess exposure to the insured over all layers of coverage. There was only $8 million in coverage, which sounds like a lot, but in underlying plaintiff's demand letter, he says he's going to blackboard specials of $10 million. Or he's going to blackboard specials of $8 million and ask the jury for an excess of $10 million. So the worst case scenario is that the insured, who was offered a $2.9 million settlement, ends up having over $2 million of personal exposure because their insurers wanted to put their own interests ahead of their insureds. The worst case scenario is excess exposure to the individual insured, not that Erie pick it up. That's my time. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Call the next case.